The starting point this evening is going to be the world of the ancient Greeks and the thinking of the ancient Greeks. And the thinking of the ancient Greeks was shaped by the development of iron technology. So my starting point is iron technology and the Greeks. And from that, I'm going to move on to some difficulties in understanding quite how the Greeks developed certain ideas. Iron is what might now be called a disruptive technology. The development of iron changed the whole world. It was developed, it was discovered, it could have been discovered as far back as 2500 BC. People talk about it being developed in the East, and very, very slowly the technology spread. It took a long time, it was kept secret. So secret that iron items were worth much more than gold items. A small iron dagger was the kind of thing that a king would give as a special present to another king with whom he wished to build good relationships. But eventually it moved towards the West. Sometime around 1200, people think it could have been around the area of Asia Minor, eventually it came into Western Europe. And among the people who got early into that technology were the Greeks. Sometime around 700 BC, iron technology really seems to have taken off. And you can see how it disrupts the world when you compare it with bronze. Bronze technology belongs to a special few. Yes. Yes, welcome. We're just starting, setting the scene in with iron technology and the ancient Greeks, so you haven't missed anything. It's no problem. The Greeks developed iron technology. Bronze technology is the special few. You've got to have copper and tin. Not many parts of Europe, only three or four, only a handful. Places like Cornwall, for example, like Bohemia, parts of Iberia have copper and tin. If you have copper and tin, you develop bronze technology early. Iron's very different. Lots of places have iron. So when iron technology starts to develop, it's much more a period of opportunity. And iron technology can change the world. Bronze is a fairly delicate metal. Iron is big and heavy. You can build axes. You can put iron nails for boats. So ships develop in the period of iron. Agriculture develops. You can build bigger ploughs. You can break out land that you couldn't otherwise cultivate. And whoever really gets out in the forefront of iron technology does well. Well, for the Greeks, they lived in a land which was comparatively poor and stony. And from an early time, they had to turn seawards for food and travel. So the Greeks were early in. The Phoenicians were also early into iron technology. They developed colonies in North Africa. This is the time when the Etruscans move into Italy. But the Greeks developed colonies on Asia Minor, an area they called Ionia. It was a time when there was a feeling of change, opportunity, communities on the move. And that base of Ionia proved an excellent one for the Greeks. Sometime around 650 BC onwards, we find a group of small Greek city-states there. Fine place, Ionia. Fertile valleys, you could grow corn and saffron and fruit. But the biggest advantage was it was a tremendous place for trade. And my goodness, the trade took off. The Greeks could go out to the people who could supply them with the raw material of iron. In return, they could send manufactured products. Trade in gold, silver, amber, ivory, flagons, vases, wine, olive oil. The kind of money that was going can be seen from the fact that just inland from the Ionian Greeks, out there on the coast of Asia Minor, just inland were the people called the Lydians. They introduced gold and silver coinage, and that developed wealth so much that the king of Lydia, King Croesus, became a byword for wealth. We still say as rich as Croesus. The Greeks developed smaller value copper coins, and that helped trade as well because it was much easier to buy and sell and give change. And it was a time of exploring and inquiring and opening up contact with other countries, other cultures. There's something about the sea and exploration that runs through the lives of the Greeks and their writings. They push forward against wind and tide. Even on the shore, they dream of the sea and the stars. The sea, said the playwright Euripides, washes all ills away. The poet Alcaeus looks up in the sky to the bright stars Castor and Pollux. He said they bring light to the black ship in the cruel night. And there are stories of great adventures by the Greeks. One of the world's great stories is the one of the Greek soldiers recruited by the Persian prince Cyrus for help in civil war. He recruited the Greeks as mercenaries. They drove all before them in battle, but the man who brought them there, Cyrus, was killed, and the Greek army was left isolated in the heart of Persian territory. The story tells how they turned north through the Armenian mountains, through uncharted lands, hostile tribes, narrow passes. So we're just at the start telling the story of the Greeks, and this is the army of Xenophon, who tells us how they went to fight in the wars in Persia and were trapped there and how to get home. They marched through deep snow sometimes. Xenophon says, we marched with a north wind blowing into our faces, cutting into absolutely everything like a knife. But they made their way home on the long trail through Asia Minor and Thrace. And, Xenophon tells us, eventually they came to a mountain, and the men in the front who had reached the summit and looked ahead began to shout, and the men behind wondered what on earth it was. Was it danger? Was it a threat? And no, they heard the words, Thalassa, Thalassa, the sea, the sea. So the Greeks were almost like the ship that seems to sniff its way through the smell of the sea, sniff its way back to harbour. And so wherever they were, they sailed and tried to find their way home, and also tried to open up new trade routes. So here we have these Greek colonists in Asia Minor, explorers, pioneers, in contact with many cultures. And something happened on there, something happened that changed the world. They certainly had plenty of money and plenty of wealth, and so art and literature could flourish. There are remains of buildings, sculptures, painted vases, poems. And the one city-state in particular, called Miletus, was the place where the foundations were laid for the subject of philosophy. The Milesians had gone down to Egypt. They'd opened up the road to Egypt in the south, to the Black Sea in the north for trade. And they had a quest. They seemed to have a quest to seek the truth, not only to seek out new ports and new routes for the ships, but to seek the truth. And they wanted to find out what exactly was the world all about. Well, the first of the great philosophers that came from Miletus was a man called Thales. He was an astronomer who foretold an eclipse of the sun, and we can now date it to a day in the year 585 BC. We're told that Thales went from Miletus to Egypt to study geometry with the priests there, and we're told that he measured the pyramids from the shadows. When he was asked what was difficult, he said, to know yourself. And when he was asked what is easy, he said, to give advice to someone else. Thales also held that the fundamental stuff of the world was water, that everything was made out of water. And this is the point at which we now look a little bit deeper into what was going on with these Ionian philosophers. It's easy nowadays to oversimplify, and we say, well, the man thought everything was made of water. Well, that's a bit odd. It seems a bit limited, a bit primitive. Far from it. There was something much deeper going on. The Ionian philosophers, the fundamental breakthrough that the Ionian philosophers made was to argue that we live in an ordered world, a world that's orderly, but without being divinely run, a world that's structured, a world that you can explain from within, a world that you can provide systematic explanations to. And I thought I'd bring along my source books this evening for two reasons. One is that I ought to be able to put the quotes into PowerPoint, but I'm not very good on PowerPoint. And two, I thought it would be nice anyway if anybody wants to look at some of the source materials. So this book in Penguin Classics is one on early Greek philosophy. And the writer, the author in this, talks about what these people did, and he says they invented science and philosophy. They hit upon that special way of looking at the world, which is the scientific or rational way. They saw the world as something ordered and intelligible, its history following an explicable course. its different parts arranged in some comprehensible system. The world was not an arbitrary collection of bits. Still less was it a series of events determined by the will or the caprice of the gods. So they had a role in their thinking for cosmic powers, but the world was something that was in some way bigger and that could be understood, and that's the key thing, the world could be understood. They have a number of concepts, a number of phrases come from them, and again, quoting from this particular book, they gave us the word cosmos, for example, and cosmology. And this word cosmos comes from a verb which means to order. Homer speaks of the Greek generals marshalling, organising their troops for battle, and he uses the word cosmos there in terms of arrangement. A cosmos is an orderly arrangement. This word order will keep coming in. They brought the word that produces the word, gave us the word that we use physics, physis, and this is about the nature of things. The physis of things is a kind of essence, a kind of internal principle that drives things, that makes things happen. They also had a concept called the archi, which was a kind of ruling principle, a fundamental principle, and the word logos, meaning an explanation. So, an orderly universe, the cosmos, with something in things, physis, a nature that takes them forward. Principles, ruling principles that seem to keep this whole structure organized, and something that we can draw out, the logos, the explanation. So, highly rational, highly organized, and we use reason to understand the universe. The universe can be understood, it's understandable, and we can understand it. Now, that is the great, great Greek breakthrough that leads to all the Greek philosophers, and it takes us right through 1,000 years of Greek philosophy until we come to the time around 529 AD when the Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian closed down the schools of Greek philosophy. But the whole of Greek philosophy flows from that starting point of an ordered universe. At this point, we can reflect a little, because if we think that the Greeks developed an ordered universe, then we pause and then we can look around Scotland. We could look around, indeed, Hector's own home of the Western Isles and look at Callanish, for example. We can look in Orkney at the Ring of Brodgar. We can actually see many sites that the Neolithic people developed that clearly showed that they believed in an ordered universe, because these stone circles, these lines of stones, these chambered cairns are aligned to motions of the sun, the moon, and indeed in some cases the stars. So they clearly knew there was an ordered universe. And in fact, we can get proof of that, because if we now go and shift a little in geography, a few thousand miles, to South America, we can find direct proof that the ancient peoples were totally convinced that the universe was ordered. Second book I'm going to quote from is written by the Belgian anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, the Jealous Potter. And this is a story of the origin of pottery. And the story goes that many, many years ago, many millennia ago, when the earth and the sky were much closer than they are today, the earth and the sky were joined by a vine. This is a story that comes from a rather interesting people called the Jivaro, and they are people who live in the cloud forests of Ecuador. They're people who are so fierce that they managed to drive out the Spanish conquistadors despite having valuable deposits of gold. Quite how they did it, it must have been an achievement, but they were extremely fierce. They were headhunters in addition. But nonetheless, according to the anthropologists that have dwelt among them, they were also fascinating people who enjoyed social evenings and stories. So this particular story about the origin of pottery comes from these people, the Jivaro. So the story is then that the earth and the sky were close together and joined by a vine. And in those days, the sun and the moon up in the sky were quite close to us. So close, in fact, that the sun and moon from time to time used to come down on earth and visit us. And indeed, they started to meet people. And eventually, the sun met a wife and came down here to spend time with his wife on earth. And so did the moon. But eventually, they discovered, to their annoyance, that it was the same person that they both met. So they had you could imagine they got a bit jealous, particularly since she told the one that she rather preferred the other one. So as a result of it, the sun and the moon started to quarrel and argue, and the woman got so upset that she wanted to escape from this whole quarrel and the jealousy and the flaws and the failings of these cosmic powers, the sun and the moon. And to escape, she started to climb up the vine that joined the earth below to the heavens above. And one of them, in anger, cut the vine, and so the woman fell to the earth. And her body, so the story goes, is the origin of potter's clay. Out of her body, that the clay of the potter comes. Now, that story is one of the key stories in the whole development of science. Because what they're saying is something truly, truly immense. What they're saying is potter's clay, and when I think of potter's clay, I either think of a powder, a shapeless, pretty shapeless powder, or a sludgy kind of mess. Anything, in fact, with less structure in it than potter's clay is very hard to imagine. But what that legend is saying is that potter's clay is far from being unstructured. Potter's clay that to us is unstructured has deep, hidden, extremely ordered structure, because it is the body of a divine power. It is the body of a figure that lived on the earth but was touched by the divine power. And we can think of a human body. A human body, of course, has a tremendous amount of internal structure. So when these people are saying that potter's clay is a body of a person from a cosmic period of time, they're saying that there's an immense structure. And you can expand, obviously, you can take that logic further, and you can say, well, there are certain things in nature that has organization and structure. And then one also can find that various people in ancient times do talk about the universe as being the body of a goddess or a god. So that is telling us that nature has a divine structure, an immense amount of order and structure. So here now is a fundamental contradiction. I started by saying that the great breakthrough of the Ionian Greeks was to decide that the world was structured. And it certainly was a breakthrough, because generations of Greek philosophy flow from that point. But yet, I'm now saying that we can go back to the Neolithic period, which is marked, for instance, by the development of pottery, and both in theory and in practice, we know that these people in the Neolithic believed in an ordered universe. We know in practice, from the various sites, the stone circles, and the orientation of the chambered cairns, and we know in theory, from particular stories like this one, coming from South America. And this is an uncontaminated story. It's not one that had been influenced by particular Western theory. It's a group of people that were largely cut off and kept the outside world well clear. So we're going deep into Neolithic thought when we go into this world of the jealous potter. So, a fundamental contradiction. Well, there's a bit more, I should say, too. Not only, and I'll stay with Levi-Strauss for a moment, not only do ancient cultures have an image like this about an ordered universe, they deal in their daily life in the language of order. In particular, and again I'm referring to Levi-Strauss's ideas, he speaks of totemism, and he speaks of totemism as a highly organized system of categorizing the world. Now, I'll give some examples of how powerful and organized a system is. I'm going to take two or three examples of what you can do with totemism and the language of totemism, and show where it takes us to. I'll start with two or three examples of what people can do. There's in Uganda, there's two groups of people in Uganda who describe human society in terms of a template, and the template is a cow. So some clans will be named after parts of the cow, the tongue or the heart or the kidneys. Others will be named after types of cow: striped cow, brown cow, cow in full milk. So you've got this template cow, and then you're starting to label particular parts of society by parts of the cow. And you can go a little bit further. In another group, in another area of Uganda, the people map the society, map the different clans in the society into a set of animals and birds. So there are the crocodile people, the hyena people, the python people, the crow people, and so on. Now, when you first read of that, you think, well, that's arbitrary. They're just picking a name for the sake. Every family group has to have a name. But they're picking them from a system. There's a rule book there. And in this particular case, it's animals and birds. And then it goes a little bit further. And Levi Strauss then points out that there is a logic. And the logic is when you contrast particular ones. So, for example, if there's a crocodile clan and a hyena clan, you must say, what are the differences between a crocodile and a hyena? The label, one label is given to one label is given to another. Why? So what are the differences? Is it, for instance, that one lives in land and the other lives in water? Is there a kind of opposition between land and water? Is that what the fundamental contrast is? Is it what, that one's furry and one's covered with scaly skin? What is it? Well, Levi Strauss takes us further. He then shows how this system works in the example of the Navajo Indians in America. And I quote, "The Navajo Indians, who regard themselves as great classifiers, divide living creatures into two categories on the basis of whether they are or are not endowed with speech. The category of creatures without speech consists of animals and plants. Animals are divided into three groups: running, flying, and crawling. Each of these groups is further divided in two ways: travellers by land, travellers by water, and travellers by day and travellers by night." Now, you might still say, well, this is fairly simple, this is pretty arbitrary stuff. But in actual fact, this division, these simple divisions, is the standard process of classification that we use in zoology and botany today. We take a plant, for example, we say, is it woody? Yes. Right. If it's yes, it's a tree, it's into the categories of trees. If it's no, it's in herbaceous plants. And we go through it. And this is the, because I didn't do biology at school, because I avoided biology as much as possible, didn't do it at university either, it was only when I was actually teaching in a school that I discovered the thing called a key that every school child learns now. And the key is simply a series of questions which you go yes, no, and it's extremely powerful. And I had an example, a botanist gave me an example, and they said, well, yes, you start, are the flowers white or coloured? Huh? Are the stems hairy or not hairy? Yes. And we went through, and in about three stages, its flowers are more mauve, yes, it's lady smock. Aha, its stems are hairy, oh no, it's wavy bit of grass. So that simple question of how you categorise, these simple categories that are used in totemism are extremely powerful, because using them you have the standard methodology of taxonomy that you use in all we use today in all our classification of plants and animals and so on. And it's interesting because the native people who developed this system possess highly systematic repertories of plant and animal species. These people, the Navajo, living in northern Arizona and New Mexico, they know more than 500 plants. There are people in the Filipinos, one group of people in the Philippines can distinguish more than 15 species of bats, 20 species of ants, and at least 45 types of edible ground mushrooms. I mean, some of these figures as to what some of these people can do is truly remarkable. These people are high quality field biologists. Now, the methodology of how you do these divisions, how you categorise the plants and animals, it seems to mean you look for shared qualities. And what you find is there's a fundamental division on where animals live. So people say, are they on land? Are they in water? Are they underground? Are they in the sky? So the Iroquois Indians in North America are into water clans, land clans, and air clans. So, for example, in water you might get the turtle clan or the beaver clan. The land clans might include the wolf clan. The air ones might be the sparrowhawk people and so on. Another example, the Osage Indians. Three types of clan: sky people, water people, dry land. And everything in the world, they start sky, water, and earth. Some more people, the Algonquin, five categories: land, water, underwater, sky, and underground. Now, think a little bit about this way of dividing the world. Land, water, sky, and underground. Land, earth, and water. Sky, air, earth, and water, and air. Underground, well, underground regions are often characterized by fire. So if you start to break up everything that exists into land, water, sky, and underground, that's earth and water and air and fire. And you see that just in a matter of minutes, talking about this simple system, apparently simple system of totemism, we've actually moved through several thousand years of history, and we're now talking the language of the ancient Celtic people and of the Greeks about four fundamental qualities of matter, about building up existence out of earth and water and fire and air, and doing so in a highly ordered and systematic manner. The Greek philosopher Empedocles taught this. He said everything in the universe comes from four elements: fire and water and earth and the endless height of air. He said just as painters, when they decorate offerings, take the many coloured pigments in their hands and mixing them, make them shapes resembling all things. So too, he said, is everything in existence made, like the painter with the colours, out of a blend of earth and water and fire and air. So, again, I'm suggesting that these ancient ideas of order are very, very powerful. But again, then, we have this paradox. How is it when in a matter of minutes we can move from totemism to that model of the four elements of earth and water and fire and air, which, after all, when we refine it, starts to become the models of atoms and then gradually, eventually, in our time, the elements of the periodic table. That analytical and ordered approach. How is it that we seem to have this huge gap between the Neolithic and the Greeks? Now, it is a colossal gap, and one of them, and there are all kinds of paradoxes. In fact, Levi Strauss admires the ancient peoples so much that he said, how is it that when the people of the Neolithic developed all the skills of pottery and agriculture and mastered them so brilliantly, how is it that there is just a gaping void in terms of science until you really come to the modern era? Even the Greeks, in Levi Strauss's opinion, were not of the same calibre as these ancient people in the Neolithic. Just one example of the Neolithic, I mentioned about their astronomy, which we can see evidence of in the various stone circles and chambered cairns. The people of the Neolithic were plant breeders, and they took a plant like maize, and it was only recently that there was crystal clear evidence as to what they did. There's a grass called Teosinte grass, and by breeding they transformed it into maize. But the difference is so huge that nobody really quite believed it, and it took DNA analysis a few years ago to show the difference. They had transformed a plant to such a degree. So they were extraordinary people in the Neolithic. But again, we come back to the question, if they were so extraordinary in the Neolithic, how is it that the Greeks suddenly, as it were, woke up one morning and said, oh my goodness, the world is ordered? Why did this come as such a big breakthrough and a big surprise? Well, let's probe a little bit more this world of the ancient Greeks. And I want to look a little bit, if I'm going to try to find out how the Greeks think, the best person to go to is going to be Homer. Because at least when we go to the poet Homer, we can look at the way he thinks and his picture of the world and see it, what it's like. Now, Homer, we're going back, we don't quite know the date. The feeling about the Trojan War is it's somewhere between 1100 and 1200 BC. That's about 400 or 500 years before this period I'm speaking about. But at least that'll take us back into Homer's thinking. And we know that Homer continued to be read right into the time of these early Greek philosophers that I'm talking about. Well, let's take Homer, and in fact, I have a feeling, though I haven't seen it, that a film has been made in recently, hasn't it, of the story of the Iliad and of Helen of Troy. I think it has, but I haven't yet seen it. But it's rather strange, in fact, making a film about that. When you go to the book Homer's Iliad, if you were writing the Iliad today, I don't think you would write it like Homer. If I was writing the Iliad today, I would write a very long, dramatic book, and I would start with something very small. I would start to introduce the various characters like Helen of Troy, and who became Helen of Troy, but of course came from Greece, Paris of Troy, who took her away from her husband and the land of the Greeks, and all the various things. And I would build this up very slowly and gradually, and show how each person did something that triggered off the next thing and how it built up. And then I think about halfway through the book, war would break out, and then we'd gradually follow the story of war, and then year by year we'd build up until the final denouement, when the Greeks are in the wooden horse and pour out of the wooden horse and sack Troy. So I would gradually build it up over a period of time. I think if I did that too, that would be a good chance of getting the rights sold for a TV series, because they kind of like it in the series, don't they? If you start gently and build up all the characters, rather than throwing all the characters in at once. Well, Homer, who's about the greatest of them all, acknowledged as the greatest, a master at handling a situation, Homer can't be bothered with anything like that building up. Homer simply starts in the 10th year of the war, when they've been battling it out for the previous 9.5. And you think, this is a bit odd. Why does he get into this so rapidly? Because surely a man with his control would want to build this up. So it's a very strange business. And in the Iliad is actually, I find it quite disturbing, because just as you're getting kind of fond of a character, you either get fond of some of the characters and you maybe don't like the others the same, but then what you discover is the good people don't seem to be rewarded or the bad people punished. In fact, it's totally arbitrary, because when A kills B, it's not a case that A is necessarily a more heroic or nicer person than B, or that B's a worse person than A. What it turns out to be is, up in Olympus, the various gods of Olympus are discussing the battle, taking extreme interest in the battle, and in fact in some cases the way somebody is killed, a hand comes down, or one of the gods of Olympus come down and either push them or influence them. The whole thing, and all these great heroes are being manipulated like marionettes in a most disturbing sort of way. For example, there's a period when there's a truce between the two sides, and the idea is that Paris and Menelaus from Greece will fight it out and have a duel, and then maybe that'll solve the whole thing and they can get out of the war. Oh no, the gods in Olympus don't want that to happen. So what happens? One of them comes down. I think it's Athena, in fact. Yes, it's Athena. Comes down from the sky. Athena comes down from the sky and immediately influences one of the archers on one side. Makes sure that the archer from one side fires an arrow which breaks the truce. So the whole time what's happening is people aren't acting from normal human motives, whether noble motives or flawed motives. They're acting because they're puppets. They're simply acting because they're being used. So this is why this is not the kind of story that we would at all be used to today. And in fact, as I say, it's a very disturbing universe. It's not, in fact, an ordered universe. But if we look in a little bit more at this, and read a little bit more about what's happening. Here's the example, indeed, when Athene comes down to Earth. And it says, like a star, sent down as a sign to sailors or to an army's broad encampment. A bright star with sparks of light streaming thick from it. That was how Pallas Athene came shooting down to earth and plummeted between the armies, like a star trailing sparks of light. And when you look at various accounts of these gods coming down from these Olympian heights in the Iliad, there are natural phenomena. There are various things happening, like sometimes they'll send a mist, or they'll send a fog, or they'll send darkness. There's something happening. And at this point, you start to wonder, in this disturbing, chaotic, unpleasant kind of world, where powers, cosmic powers outside, are influencing the world below, could there actually be, could these elements be a clue to something, some natural disturbance that's going on and that's affecting the whole order? Well, one of the really fascinating studies in recent years that's been made of Homer's Iliad was made by an American lady called Edna Lee Wood. And Edna Lee Wood found that the Iliad was not only disturbing from the reasons I've said, for the reasons of this apparent chaoticness, but it was a bit odd because the Iliad has long lists, from time to time, long lists of people, like it might have a long list of soldiers who come from a particular place, and it seemed quite particular to say that A and A killing B and B killed C, and there's quite a lot of minute detail which really didn't make anything in the story. These various lists, these various descriptions that were rather dull. And she wondered what was going on. Well, we know, because various people have looked at this over a period of time, we know that the names of these gods and goddesses were associated with planets. We know that the goddess Aphrodite, for example, is associated with the planet Venus. We know it from various times. We know because there are ancient authors. There's the author Lucian in the 2nd century AD, who simply said the Iliad seems to be a battle between the goddess Aphrodite and the god Ares. It seems to be, and he said, meaning Venus and Mars. So that idea that these cosmic powers were in some way associated with planets was there. Edna Lee Wood eventually made a breakthrough. She read the Iliad so often she could quote it from memory, but she constantly found this detail didn't seem to be going anywhere. She said, Homer, so it seemed to me, was saying something very clearly, yet something I didn't grasp. She was working full-time as a teacher, so her study of Homer had to be carried out in the evening. Sometimes she'd work into the early hours of the morning, sometimes for the whole night. But eventually the pieces began to come together, and she said, when Homer wrote of the wine dark sea, he wanted us to look at the heavens, not the oceans. Her health wasn't good enough for her to write it up, but she left her manuscripts, and her son and her daughter-in-law, Florence and Kenneth Wood, wrote up a book about it. And the conclusion she came to is that Homer was writing with a kind of intricate code. Lengthy lists of soldiers denote constellations. A commander of that list of soldiers is the bright star. The commanders are the brightest stars. When a warrior kills another, the one that kills the other is the brighter of the two stars. She's found complex descriptions of landscapes that she can interpret as stellar geographies. When a hero vanishes from the battlefield, she can equate that with a star sinking below the horizon. And she believes that underneath the story of the Iliad is the astronomical phenomenon of the precession of the equinoxes. This is the wobble in the Earth's axis. That means that over a period of about 26,000 years, the pole star gradually alters. The point in the sky that the Earth's axis points to gradually alters. The sun will rise in its spring equinox in one constellation rather than another. And she says that the fall of the House of Troy, told in the Iliad, corresponds to the decline of the star Thuban in Draco as the pole star. And along with it, the lower part of the constellation Ursa Major. in the night sky. Now, other people have been looking at this idea that some of these ancient legends are talking about the precession of the equinoxes. Two historians of science, Giorgio de Santayana and Hertha von Deschend, wrote a book called Hamlet's Mill, which influenced Edna Lee, and they admired and encouraged her research. And they have an interesting reference to the fall of Troy. They speak about a star called the Fox Star, which associated with destruction by various people, which seems to be associated with Troy. And one of the ancient writers says that this Fox Star is the mother of the founder of Troy, and says that when the city fell, she was so distressed that she left her home in the Pleiades and took up her present position. So people are talking again about disturbances or disruptions in the sky as connected with Troy. Furthermore, De Santayana and von Deschend say, look at the shield of Achilles, the destroyer of Troy. On it, Achilles, you can see two constellations, Ursa Major and the Pleiades, which again, in ancient legends, are associated in various stories with catastrophe. So a number of people are suggesting that something to do with cosmic catastrophe is there. Just to summarise, Edna Lee Wood said she sees all kinds of astronomical data there in the Iliad, and she thinks it's something to do with a change in sky, a change from one pole star to another. And other people, I mentioned in the book Hamlet's Mill, associate certain stories in the sky with the fall of Troy and catastrophe. Now, you might say this is extremely hypothetical, but now we move on to something really concrete in modern science. A man called Professor Mike Bailey of Queen's University, Belfast. Mike Bailey is an expert on dendrochronology, that's tree ring dating. And the tree ring dating people are really brilliant. How they could do it, they'll get a particular sequence of trees, they'll get the tree rings, then from another part of the world they'll get another series of tree rings, they'll identify a similar pattern in terms of thicknesses of tree rings, because the theory being, of course, that in a good year you get a broad tree ring, in a bad year you get a thinner tree ring. And the tree ring experts, such as Mike Bailey, can go back now several thousand years. In that sequence of several thousand years, there are occasional points, if we go back over the last 5,000 years ago, there are occasional points at which something quite weird happens in the tree rings. Points at which the tree ring specialists find a run of very, very narrow tree rings. A run which suggests a period of several years of climatic disruption. Disruption so major that plants grew very little, and if you get very little growth in plants for a period of 5 or 6 years, you can imagine what kind of consequences you have for the animals that feed on the plants, and of course the people like us. So by piecing together the growth rings from trees, whether they're long-lived trees today, older ones in peat bogs, in fact the total distance they can now go back is actually 9,000 years. I find that absolutely extraordinary. Some of it is bog oak, for example, oak in the Irish peat bogs, they can go back 9,000 years. But Mike Bailey highlights four particular points in the last 5,000 years where you get a really disturbing run of very, very narrow tree rings, showing something going wrong with the climate. One of the dates is 1628 BC, second date 1159, third date 207 BC, fourth date 540 AD. The 540 AD is a really interesting one, because that takes us into the history, a period of Scottish history, and all kinds of things are starting to happen with the Picts and the Scots around that time. And that is also a time which the Arthurian legends are suggested, and Mike Bailey has given his book a fascinating title, which there wouldn't be time now to go into, but if you're looking for it, it's called Exodus to Arthur, Catastrophic Encounters with Comets. And he's actually suggesting that some of the Arthurian legends and some of the events, such as some of the images, I think it's suggested when the figure of Merlin and Arthur was born, there were dragons seen fighting in the sky. Some of those images, he says, are astronomical. He's also suggesting a link, by the way, of the 1628 one with the Exodus, with some of the phenomena in Exodus, and that's a complete story in its own right. But I'd like to link this in particular with the 1159 one, when, as I say, there's a major dislocation in climate around 1159. He explores this, and he finds that about 1159, the middle of the 12th century, that's the time traditionally associated for the fall of Troy, and he quotes from a Roman author, Hyginus, who refers to a comet as bright as the sun seen in the sky at the time of the conquest of Troy. So Mike Bailey suggests that although it's possible that volcanic action could be one of the things that produces dust in the air and dramatically cuts down the growth of things, he also suggests that a number of descriptions from various periods suggest that there's something in the sky happening. It could be a near approach of a comet, it could be an impact of a meteor, but something cosmic seems to be happening. Comets are traditionally associated with ill fortune, and Mike Bailey's suggestion, and as I said, this is coming from somebody who's really rooted in the earth quite very much with the study of tree rings, and is what you might call a sound scientist who's not given to flights of fantasy. Mike Bailey says we have to explain these tree rings. There's something major happening. From the ancient sources, in a number of cases, there do appear to be things happening in the sky. So, the point I'm coming to is this. Is it the case that we can explain some of the phenomena in the Iliad, which seem to be astronomical, which seem to be speaking of a cosmic conflict, which seem to be speaking about something in the sky that's a bit disorderly, almost like the powers in the sky turning against us, influencing down below? Could we actually put that together and suggest that's what's going on in the Iliad, a period of grave disorder? Now, if we did that, a piece falls into place in the jigsaw, because we now have an explanation for the hiatus between the ordered universe of the Neolithic people, and now we're going back to 3000 BC, and the ordered universe, the discovery of the ordered universe by the Greeks. Because what's actually happening is, at certain points in between, the people of these various ancient cultures saw the universe as very much disordered, because something was happening in the heavens, such as a near impact of a comet or the impact of a meteor. Something was happening in the heavens which suggested that the world was not predictable, and that some cosmic power was capriciously interfering into the affairs of men. Well, it is interesting, because one of the people who looked at the way in which the Greeks developed the idea of order is a man called Francis Cornford. And Cornford went into quite precise detail about the way in which the picture of the universe in Homer gradually seemed to move into the picture of the Ionian philosophers. He noted that although the gods of Homer were very powerful, and I've just said in the Iliad how powerful they were, nonetheless, even those powerful Olympian gods had a limit. The one limit they had was destiny, the Greek words moira for destiny. They didn't make it, and they couldn't stand up against it. And he speaks a bit about how the concept of order gradually seems to emerge as we move away from Homer. He said even these powerful gods in Homer had an area of space that they couldn't get away from. The sky god Zeus had the sky, Poseidon had the sea, Hades had the underworld. And Cornford suggested that there was a kind of spatial and localized idea that was developing in Greek thinking, a kind of spatial idea, and that as the Greeks gradually developed this idea of moira, of fate, of destiny, what it was coming from was a division by putting limits and boundaries. So in other words, when Zeus was seen as a sky god, what was significant wasn't so much the power in the sky as the limit, the fact that there was a limit around the sky, and that and that the power didn't extend beyond that. So he also looked at ideas about binding, how the gods, these powerful gods, were bound by an oath. The word was horkos for the oath, and he noted it was the same word as herkos, fence. So he talked very much about the transition from the world of Homer to the ordered world of the Ionian philosophers as a way of thinking that involved limits, marking out territory and putting boundaries on the territory. And he linked it with the idea I've mentioned previously, totemism. Remember I said that totemism was splitting people into people who lived on land, people who lived in water, people who lived on the sky, and so on. So he felt that this kind of thinking was the start of the orderly and rational thinking that was coming in. Now at this point, I'd like to bring some of these elements together. What I'm point coming to is the suggestion that between the orderly world of the Greeks and the orderly world of the Neolithic, we have several thousand years. And the reason that the Greeks were working so hard and making what to them was such a breakthrough of saying the world was orderly was because their ancestors had experienced a world that was frighteningly disorderly and frighteningly capricious. And when the Greeks were gradually saying that the world was run on principles and not on the caprice of some of these various Olympian gods, that was a huge breakthrough. Now, that then opens up a question. Is there anybody else, is there any other source that we could look at for this breakthrough in thinking? And when you think about it, the idea that fire is coming down from the sky and hitting you out of the blue, totally without any merit or demerit in you, well, the place we find that is the Book of Job. The Book of Job is the classic one about somebody, because the issue in the Book of Job is about someone who leads a right and moral life, which is in harmony with the principles of the universe, but is suddenly out of the blue something happens. And the first thing I would like to say about the Book of Job, it's the astronomical language in it is particularly interesting. Way in which it said right at the very start how something comes up. The phrase actually in there, it's in 1:16, the fire of God fell from the sky. And that's interesting because that language is very much the same language. In fact, I think that's right. I'm delighted there are some Bibles here, I think, aren't there? In fact, if you have a copy, it would be good to turn to it. I'm going to read from some of the bits in it, but it would be good to do because you can, in a sense, make up your mind, I think, what you think about some of these particular quotes. So, right at the very start, and there's obviously different translations, right at the very start, there is the discussion between the Lord and Satan, and in Chapter 2, it starts by saying, one day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. Now it's Satan that's involved in striking down at Job. But it's interesting that in that first sentence, Satan is associated with something in the sky. One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And it goes on because then there's the discussion, and Satan is eventually, Satan is eventually given permission to strike down Job and Job's property. And there's a particularly interesting phrase that comes in there, where he talks about to destroy him for no reason. And there's various translations of the word for no reason, without cause, undeservedly. To destroy him for no reason. And I think that's a particularly interesting thing, because that is the point of this, is it's not merit or demerit. In other words, it's not a kind of ordered world in which there are values and rewards and punishments according to your merits. It's a world in which suddenly, out of the sky, destruction can come, quite capriciously. So my first point is, that is very much the language that we found in the Iliad, and it's very much the kind of phenomena that we found in the study of the tree ring, something coming out of the sky. When we follow the story in the book of Job, the question is why, and Job asks again and again why, and they have different, the friends come in. Eliphaz the Temanite more or less says, well, it's probably something you've done, we'll just have to look and see what it is, but you'd better just appeal for mercy. That's no answer for Job, it's because it's not going deep. Bildad, the next one, says, well, you must find out what it is that you're doing or not doing, find out and ask for mercy. And Zophar simply says, you just have to recognize there's a greater power, a bigger power than you. But none of those answers seems to satisfy, and Job probes and probes and probes and asks. And eventually, the voice comes out of the storm. And it's most extraordinary. I mean, many of you will be more familiar than I am with this, but I find each time I go to this, the sheer power, we're only reading it in translation, goodness knows what it must be like to people who can read Hebrew, but the power of it, and of course the power of the authorized translation, it's absolutely extraordinary. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a couple of sections of this, and I'm going to ask you if any word in that text stands out, or if any word as you listen to it reminds you of anything that I've said up to now. Just purely. So here's the voice. It says, then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. And this is what he says. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me, if you understand, who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone, while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place? When I said, this far you may come and no farther, here is where your proud waves halt? Any words or any thoughts that come to mind about this, any concept, any word or any concept seems to stand out there, any particular one?
Boundaries.
Absolutely. Limits. Boundaries. Isn't it really the language of boundaries? And there's a precision. I mean, it's talking about boundaries in words like cornerstone. And it's also extremely, I find, extremely reassuring. It's interesting because there's two ways of reading this. Now, one way that this has been looked at is simply that the voice is simply saying, who are you to ask? How you are a small, inadequate individual on a small scrap of earth. How dare you ask? Who do you think you are asking? And that Job is being slapped down for asking. But there's a second way to look at this, and the second way is to say, again, you're a very small person, but this whole universe is not designed to play games with you or reward you or punishing you. You're totally irrelevant to it. This whole universe runs on a huge, deep, powerful order, but this order is not then designed to play tricks on you. It's an order there. Therefore, you need not feel that something is coming after you or playing with you. And that, it seems to me, is reassuring. But the language is limits and boundaries. Now, remembering what I said about how the Greek philosophy developed, out of this language of sections. Remember how I talked about totemism and how the concept of totemism, you break the universe into land living, sea living, water living, and how the ideas that Francis Cornford spoke about is how you move from that to the elements and the divisions, and also how, as the Greeks developed this idea of an ordered universe, they talked about limits. The gods in Homer actually had boundaries and limits, and there was something, destiny, that was bigger than they were. What I feel is being said here is something truly momentous. Job is being told that he lives in an ordered universe. It may appear to Job that something happens, something falls from the sky, something goes wrong, and it may appear to Job that that is caprice, that's disorder. It's not. It's part of a bigger order. The fact that Job cannot understand that bigger order is nothing to do with it. That's his problem. The fact is, it's an ordered universe. In other words, phenomena that we don't understand may happen, but those phenomena aren't caprice, the sound of someone pulling strings. They are part of a bigger and total order. Now, that bigger and total order does not in any way devalue the theological model. I'm not here moving into the territory of suggesting that the order is sufficient. The debate obviously is the theological, the straight theological analysis of that is, as the voice in the storm says, God created that order. But whether that order was created by God, or whether somebody kind of takes it a more material way and says the order was there in the first place, this is still saying that we live in an ordered universe. I think the way this is said is more powerful than the material one. I think the language in this is so incredible and so rich that I think the theological case is made absolutely magnificently. I think anybody who was purely, suppose somebody was purely a scientist and had never ever read any theology in their lives, I think when they came to this, their thinking would certainly be enriched. But the language is very clear. It's, and this chapter, this voice in the storm, is uniting science and theology. We're now at a watershed where the language of theology and the language of science are all combining and being expressed in this magnificent poetry in the same way. The voice, for instance, goes on, and you can see some more of them. Can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons, or lead out the bear with its cubs? Talking again about, and you can see the language of order. It's actually saying, bring forth the constellations in their seasons. There is structure in the universe. Again, it goes on, who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied his ropes? I gave him the wasteland as his home, the salt flats as his habitat. And you see this language, the language of location, the language of space, the language on which things have boundaries, and this is all part of order. And again, will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will he stay by your manger at night? Can you hold him to the furrow with a harness? Once again, this language, hold him to a furrow with a harness. Will he till the valleys behind you? So, all I'm doing, I think, to round off, is asking questions. I don't think I have answers. I think the answers are there in the text, and the answers are there for people to research into them. What I'm saying is the following. The big, big development in Greek thought, as I've said, is the development of the concept of order. It's not as simple that they woke up one morning and got it. They developed that concept out of something more traumatic, which was this capricious, disordered universe. Other texts seem to be talking the same language. I think that the book of Job says the same thing as the Ionian philosophers did. And I think in many ways it says it much better, in a much richer and more beautiful and a deeper way. Because when we read the Ionian philosophers, it's not at all clear that what it is that they're making the breakthrough. When people write about them, they tend actually to make it, it's really quite dry. It's just, oh well, they saw that the universe was ordered, and you think, yeah, well, that's very nice, thank you very much, and on we go to the next philosopher and the next. Whereas in the book of Job, it's coming right to the crunch, and it's saying everything, the fundamental question in life is, do we live in an ordered universe or a disordered? If we live in a disordered universe, it's absolutely frightening. But the message of Job is ultimately reassuring. Yes, it's an ordered universe. Yes, there are boundaries. The power of the sea, all sorts of powers, chaotic powers, have limits on them and boundaries on them. And the overarching power of the voice that's coming there is a voice of order and structure. And Job then is being told not simply that he should keep quiet and not ask any questions, and that he's a nobody and a nonentity, and he crawls away. He's actually being told, look, don't worry, you are a nobody and a nonentity, but be relieved about it, because we don't care. Nobody else out there is bothering. Nobody else is going to annoy you or trouble you. You live your life. Do what you have to do. Obey the proper principles, and it's all right. And you see, it's interesting, because right after that voice speaks out of the storm, Job essentially says, ah, yes, I see, goes away, and that's it. He prospers after that. And I think that is a tremendous moment. I think it's a most beautiful moment, this incredible power in the poetry, amazing depth in the thought. So I feel, to round off at this point, there's a huge amount of questions to answer. And there's a wonderful territory, it seems to me, for scholars in these different disciplines, particularly theology and philosophy. One of the huge questions is the dating of the Book of Job, for example. Wonderful. I would be fascinated to know what the different ideas are. Where does it come from? What are the influences on the Book of Job? Who wrote it? What were the circumstances in which they wrote it? What were the circumstances of the society in which this was written? So there's a huge amount of study. But in the end, I feel that not only is this some of the greatest of poetry and theology of all time, but I do firmly believe that this is at the watershed of Western science as well. And in our time, where science sometimes has gone off in its own direction, and sometimes we see the directions it goes in, and they can be disturbing ones. It's no bad thing, I think, to go back to where all these disciplines come from and see that at the heart of them, right at the watershed, there is something as deep and profound as this. Thank you very much.